This is Limitless Possibility. I'm Yannick Magnan.
And I'm Luc-Olivier Dumeblet.
And our topic this week is...
the future of desktop class apps on the iPad.
Oh, interesting. First, we have some follow-up. Do you want to go first?
Yes. I have another film photography-related follow-up item. And this one comes from Petapixel, and it has been... reported by a few places, but that's the link I have included in the show notes. But Kodak Aloris, which is owned by the UK Pension Protection Fund, is looking to sell this business. So just a quick reminder on what is quote-unquote modern Kodak. After their bankrupt of 2012, the Kodak business that used to exist for 100 years got split into two divisions. The one that you might be already familiar of from the US, which is called Eastman Kodak, which is more or less the film manufacturer. And also take care of distribution of cinematography film. But for a lot of the rest of the other businesses, most importantly for this conversation, the film product distribution, so 35mm, all the photography film is handled by Kodak Aloris, which means they also own all the branding, so Kodak Gold, Kodak Portra, things like that. But they do not manufacture that said film. And the reason that somebody in the UK, more or less a pension plan, ended up with it is because during the bankruptcy, the Kodak pension plan was owed, Kodak was owing a lot of money to that pension fund. So more or less, they end up with it. And more or less recently, from I think a couple of weeks ago, they kind of announced, or it's not clear if they've officially announced it, but it was known by people in the domain that they're more or less trying to sell that part of the business, which is going to be interesting because twofold, we don't know for how much they want to sell it for, and when is the exact sell starting, to put it this way. But like I mentioned, Kodak Aloris for the film itself could be considered the distributor. So with all the film shortage and things like that, it is interesting to see that the distributor part might not be doing so well, whereas the manufacturer part, Eastman Kodak in the US, is doing quite well, and also doing quite well, like I mentioned in a previous episode, in the previous follow-up section, manufacturing film photos, including Fuji. So, or quote-unquote including Fuji, because there's no real evidence of that, except made in the US on the box of new Fujifilm product. So, again, it is interesting news for people like me that want to do more film photography in the recent days, and especially making some weird things happen or creating uncertainty in the Kodak land of these two companies coexisting to distribute film product throughout the world. That's it for my follow-up section. What's yours, Yannick?
Back in 2013, rumors started to come out that Sony Pictures was working on a Gran Turismo movie, and everybody thought that was the stupidest thing they'd ever heard. Well, this week, we got the trailer for the Gran Turismo movie, which is releasing in August, and it confirms that indeed, that is a very stupid idea, and that they shouldn't be making this. But just to give some extra context on sort of like the production of this movie, like they started working on it in 2013. Then they sort of completely flipped the cast. The cast that was working on the film in 2015. And then they scrapped all of that in 2018 to get a whole new staff. And then they started developing that new iteration of it back in May of 2022. And basically, like, they finished filming in December of 2022, and they are cranking out this movie really, really fast, which is entirely based around the story of GT Academy Esports, which is incredibly self-indulgent. It is... it's kind of a joke. The other thing that's kind of interesting in the whole perspective of this is there's a Japanese movie that came out last year called Alive Hoon, which was basically the same idea, except instead of being based on the actual GT Academy program, it was made up. It was just like some guy played Gran Turismo and then became one of the best drift racers. Like, can you believe this gamer is better than all of these professional drift racers? It was just, like, such a wild concept for a movie. But I can't, like, it made sense because it wasn't, like, an official Sony thing. It was kind of just something someone made up on the spot. I have similar experience with a DDR movie that came out in the past, and a Spanish DDR movie called La Máquina de Bailar. It wasn't, like, officially licensed by Konami, but it was an actual movie about playing DDR, and it was crazy. And Alivehoon is kind of, like, in that ballpark. This is just surreal, though, because it's an official Gran Turismo movie. Yeah, I think the trailer kind of was a disappointment. Actually, even before you get to the trailer, the thumbnail for the trailer has a big red flag on it, which is the Gran Turismo logo itself is in Gran Turismo 5 styling, which is weird. The Gran Turismo logo font is not the Gran Turismo logo font. It's just some generic Hollywood bullshit. It's so bad. One of my friends pointed out on Twitter that there's a shot where you see like a pile of Gran Turismo games on the console, and they were like, is there a problem with the spines of the Gran Turismo boxes? Why are the Gran Turismo logos not on the side of the boxes? And that's just because it's the European versions, which have crappy spines. But I don't know. This movie is going to be a disaster, at least to me. It seems like it's going to be a disaster. I know you also watched the trailer. I think we're pretty much on the same page for this one, I think.
I agree with everything you said. When you reminded me that that was in the plans, and also that now there's a trailer out, I was utterly worried that it would be, they would try to make it an arcade racing style movie on top of Gran Turismo, and we all know as Gran Turismo fan that that's not the Gran Turismo game. So to see this spin is kind of, oh, at least they haven't done like a Need for Speed movie, or I think there was a Need for Speed movie.
I think there was.
It was okay, you know, it was kind of the typical American action car movie, or what, I guess what is Fast and Furious nowadays is just a movie about guns and explosions. So I'm kind of happy that they didn't went there, but it was not a big ask of them. So to kind of being so self-indulgent about, oh, somebody is willing to win Gran Turismo Academy, GT Academy, and then it's like, oh yeah, it's based on somebody that did that, and then started to race. Yeah, it's like, I don't know.
The other thing that's really interesting is, like, if you look at recent video game movies, like, I'm thinking especially of the two most recent Sonic movies and the Super Mario movie.
Yes.
The people who made those movies are incredibly in love with those series. And regardless of how the actual, like, movie came out, whether you liked it or not, there are so many little references to random shit that only the most hardcore fans would know. Like, I saw someone who was, like, freaking out because the Super Mario movie has, like, a remix of a song that showed up in one minigame in Mario Party on the N64. And they were freaking the fuck out because this song that they haven't heard since the N64 days is now getting a new version in the Mario movie of all things. So, like, I don't see them really doing that with Gran Turismo. Like, they're not going to put the yellow Evo from Gran Turismo 2000 or any of the other, like, token memes from Gran Turismo shitposts in the movie, because I don't think these people are tuned in enough into, like, the Gran Turismo fan community to actually get it, which is kind of disappointing.
Do you think, I'm sure I'll butcher the name because I always do, but do you think there'll be a Suzuki Escuda?
Escudo? No, probably not.
Escudo, so yes.
Especially since this movie is heavily sponsored by Nissan, which also sponsors GT Academy, right?
So, right.
My personal Easter egg that I'm going to be looking forward to in this movie is if the Nissan headquarters in Yokohama show up, because I'm used to walking multiple times a day in that building.
And last up about Nissan, like, I remember clearly that we've seen a couple of Skylines, the latest generation, which is more or less dead. Let's be honest. And I don't think we've seen any of the new Z car. So, like, Nissan, even if they try, like, I know they have the Sentra Cup here in Canada and they're trying to be racy, but their racing pedigree or their sports car pedigree is well in the past. So it's kind of ironic that it's also sponsored by them still.
Yeah, I don't know. This comes out in August, on August 11th. I'm probably not going to see it in the theater, but when that comes out on streaming or whatever, I will check it out. And maybe we can do an episode on it.
That would be neat. On my front, it reminded me that there is a couple of movies like movie based on video games I haven't watched. A good example that was released semi-recently is Uncharted. It reminded me of the Uncharted movies. I was like, oh yeah, I heard mixed reviews on this, and B, I didn't go see it. So I guess I'll have to A, fix that at some point. But for sure, with Gran Turismo, I don't want to go pay $20, $25 to go watch this at the cinema. Like, hell no.
I sent this to my brother, and he was like, wow, every video game's getting a movie these days. It doesn't matter if it makes sense. Also related to that, on Apple TV Plus, there's the Tetris movie now, which I keep seeing ads for everywhere.
Yes.
It looks absolutely crazy. It's probably going to be better than Gran Turismo, but I can't imagine by that much.
Right, because my understanding of that movie is more of like kind of a drama around the creation of the Tetris game.
Yes. Although I would say like both of these movies are technically based on a true story.
Fair.
Anyway, that's enough about the movie for now. We'll report back when it's released. Now let's get into the main topic.
Good. So this week, we will be talking about the iPad and the apps that can or that we wish it could run, and explain what I see in the future for desktop class apps. And I think I want to start this episode or this topic by kind of talking about myself for sure, but by Yannick and I. Like, we are people that I think it's fair to say that love the iPad.
Yes.
We've been iPad owners for myself since the iPad first generation, since the first iPad. I think it's the same for you, Yannick.
Yeah, I imported one from the US before they were out here.
Oh, yeah, I forgot that. I bought mine on the Canadian launch, but no, yeah, I forgot about that. And I think since then, we did have iPad of some modernity, so maybe a couple of years old iPad throughout our life. While we are people that love the iPad, we're not, and okay, I was about to say it in a certain way that sounds pessimistic, but we're not trying to do everything on it. We do have specific action operation or types of things we like to do on those devices, but our iPad is not our computing life.
So I think for me it makes up a lot more of a percentage of my computing life than it does for you.
Yeah, and I think that's why I want to discuss about a specific type of application on the iPad, is because that's more or less the gist of this episode, is throughout the years that changed for me. And now with the push of trying to make more fully fledged application, and use this word desktop class, or adjective, I should say, I kind of want to go through that. And again, you and I are still developers. So depending on which technology we use, it can be possible to make some development on it. For me as an iOS developer, I'll consider it near impossible. I know people have done amazing things with the new version of Swift Playground that you could develop an app on it, but hey, personally, I haven't tried that new version too much, nor would I can make use of that in a professional setting on the apps I do work on.
Actually, just to jump in here, you just reminded me that that was possible. I completely forgot that that was even an option. And the interesting thing is I forgot to mention this on the show. I got an iPhone 14 a couple of weeks ago.
And true, that's true.
Yeah, the reason I didn't talk about it is because, kind of like what we discussed on that episode, it is completely uneventful as a phone update. It has a better camera and a better battery, and I have used the camera once since I've gotten the phone. Oh, wow.
Okay, yeah.
So, yeah, completely uneventful. But as part of updating to this phone, the app that I was using to track life totals when I play Magic the Gathering broke. And there are a bunch of other ones on the App Store, but I hate them all. So I was thinking about writing my own, and it's literally just keeping track of like two variables and keeping the screen from sleeping. So I'm pretty sure I could just do that in Swift Playgrounds and give it a try and see how it turns out.
Yeah, no, I think you're correct. If you're willing to go Swift and Swift UI is my recollection.
I mean, I want to learn it, so I might as well.
Then for that, it would be pretty neat. Not that I forget, because I didn't do... Oh, I should say, for this part of the intro of my notes for this episode, I didn't do research of saying, hey, Swift Playground, what can it do exactly as a more Xcode-lite application? But I remembered it, and I was kind of like, oh, yeah, that's true. I could also try to do small projects with it. But maybe we can discuss that in the later episode. But I guess it all goes back to the feeling that I'm not sure if it's what I want. That's the type of use case I want to do on the iPad, but I'm quite curious too. But that's our, I guess that's the way to end this bigger tangent. But going back to the original point is more or less on a professional life, the type of work we do, Yannick and I, and especially me as an iOS developer, more or less requires a macOS computer, or at least a desktop, or a desktop operating system, if I want to be a bit more generic, because knowing that Yannick uses Windows for work.
Yeah, and even if I wanted to use an iPad, I don't think I'm going to be writing Linux desktop and Android apps, which are the current things I'm working on an iPad.
Right. So, now that we've defined that we both like the iPad, I kind of want to go through a couple of things that I do with my iPad. That made me think about desktop class applications. If I ignore the typical things I would call light usage, web browsing, emailing, or cleaning up my emails inbox, content consumption, I would say watching YouTube, watching any streaming application, I would also include for our more video game focus listeners, Twitch streaming, things like that, where you consume that. Like, I was like, yeah, that's what I would consider quote unquote light usage. If I use the word light, I don't mean to downplay it. It's just like, it's more that you enjoy what your machine in front of you or your computer in front of you can give you access to. But if I look at when I need to use more powerful application, if I can say so, or I need to create things. Yes, the main thing I do personally would be photo editing and photo management. Again, I would use a word processor, a spreadsheet software, things like that. But if I look at what I do on my personal life, that would use a lot of computing powers and a lot of desktop class OS's functionality, it is 100% sure photo editing and photo management. In the recent weeks, while this is not a photo episode, and I put this warning and I'll repeat it, I've been reevaluating my current photo management and photo editing process, and one aspect of it became quite clear. And if you remember my previous episode, one of my goals during photo management is I want to have... I said in the past a similar experience, but I want to have the exact same experience both on the iPad and on macOS. And that aspect that became clear is even if I said that, I rarely use my iPad nowadays to do that. And I've discovered that it was because of a main topic, is that in general, for a lot of the application I can use on both systems, the iPad version is dumbed down. It misses important features that I need in my own process. And again, you could say that this process is my own version and that could be changed. But I think some of those functionality are a bit more outside of the norm too. I think the best example I can give, and that will be the only thing photo management related I want to discuss, but it's more or less, now that I'm shooting film and I'm using app to track exposure values, I want to then encode that back in the scans that I received. And a lot of the application that I have on iPad either cannot do that or they're a bit finicky and not really well designed for that feature. I would even say that on macOS, it's even hard to build a proper photo management pipeline where your image goes one from one software to the other, or you try to minimize the number of software to do that. So all of this is to say is these issues with photo management made me think about the issues about software itself on those different platforms. And at that point, the main thing that I realized is that the disparity of experiences between a software that runs on both platforms is what is slowing me down. I feel blocked that I cannot execute complex workflow that I can do in one version of the application on a desktop platform that on the iPad, it's not happening. So based on that, I want to go through the definition of, you know, what makes this sense of a desktop class application. I know I'm using the same verbiage as Apple when they've introduced a new functionality in iPadOS, but that's the reason I want to define what I mean by desktop class. I want also to see what are the typical types of application or what makes more of a mobile application and the differences between this mobile class versus desktop class. And then see what can we do or what I wish could be done to make this situation better. And I think the timing is great because I don't want it to make it a WWDC wishing wish list episode.
It kind of is one.
I don't have exact point, but I think the timing is correct because I think it's a good time to reflect on what I like that is available on the iPad and what I maybe dislike, and also what could be improved in the future, and more broadly, how it can be fixed or even should it get fixed. That this perception that the iPad is not desktop enough. Good. So before we go defining this perception and what needs to change on the iPad, I want to define what is a desktop class application. Exactly what I mean by that is what makes a distinction between an app that could run on a phone, on a tablet, like what about the feature or what the functionality or how it integrates with iOS OS that would make it more... I dare to try to use the pro adjective here, but I don't want to go there. But I think that is just a step of its own. So, to me, a desktop class app can take advantage of its OS. And especially, and that's... put it lightly, take advantage of the powerfulness of the file system. And what I mean by that is I want to be able to have access to the underlying content that I create and decide what I can do with it. More or less saying, if I create data in a tool, I want to have access to this data and not have to hack around. It should be an easy access to this data. The next point is I think a desktop class application should allow you to take full advantage of the raw power of, or your raw computing power, whether it's from the CPU, whether it's GPU, everything that is that your device is capable of, this software is optimized to take full advantage of. Next, I think a software that can be considered desktop class should have a certain level of information and functionality density. I don't want to access all the functionality of the software all at once or all the information stored in the software all at once, but to kind of go back to a photo management example, if I open a photo editing software, I do want to have the ability to customize the tools that I use the most so that they are easily accessible. When I edit the photo, when I'm in the photo ingesting mode, I want to make sure that I can change as much metadata as I can because photos contains a lot of metadata, things like that. And again, those are examples based on photos, but those could apply to different type of content. Same thing we could say with a, like, a word processor. You want to have access to all the text formatting tools and be able to customize the user experience and the UX, the UI, excuse me, to have the tools you use the most in front of you and not rely only on the makers of the software to tell you what to do best. Easily, the next point is to be able to, and I think it relates quite well with the first point, is if I have access to my data, I can easily share it between apps and also possibly inside the application itself. And what I mean by that is possibly have integrations with different applications in my system so that they can exchange data in between each other. And I think the WordPress, like the iWork suite, does that well. Even the Adobe Creative Suite, even if we consider they're pretty, we can complain about Adobe all day long. I think if there's one thing that they do well is you have a photo in Lightroom, you want to open it in Photoshop and go crazy in Photoshop, you can do that. Another Apple example that might be more on the Apple side is the integration between Final Cut and Logic and the other video tools that I'm currently blanking on their name.
Motion and all thank that you. Stuff.
Yes, that's the one. That
compressor.
Was motion and compressor. But yeah, so you can take your audio from your video clips, send it to compressor or send it to Logic, have the impress, and then quickly come back to those tools while still retaining the possibility to manage that data yourself. But you don't have to think about, okay, I need to close Final Cut, open it myself. There's those, I was about to say first party, but integrations in general inside the application.
Yeah, but I think it's also interesting because you sort of have the flexibility. If you have the access to the raw data files, you always have the flexibility of just using tools that were not designed to work together and designing your own workflow. And I mean, there are tools that enable this on iPad, but they are more limited and clunkier.
No, I think you're making a good point. And the order of the points are not in our priority order. I think there are just... Yeah. In general, but you're correct that this one and the next point are maybe a little bit less important. But I think overall, I think this one is a bit more utopic. I think I can dare to say that. Because in the best world, I would say all apps would be able to provide those integration to all other apps. But that's not the world we live in. So,
oh, no, definitely. I'm not trying to say that it's a perfect world on the iPad either. I'm just saying, like, you have more of that on the Mac because you have generally access to the raw files. And once you have access to the file, you can just pass it off to whatever knows what that file type is. Whereas on iPad, you might have an app that can actually open that file type. But if it doesn't have, like, the right type of extension for your use case, then you might actually be completely screwed. And then you have no way of getting it there. Or you have to work around by putting it in files first, and then it becomes, like, this whole complicated mess.
Right. You kind of have to do file management on top of your file manager, which is, I see what you mean. Last but not least, that might sound weird for an app itself, but... the app should be designed to work in a system where multiple apps can run at the same time. And the reason I bring this up is, yes, the sharing data is a good example. You might be doing your things in Final Cut. Oh, crap. I have a title card I need to post. I need to change the image there. And then not pause the app, not suspend it, leave it running and go do that. Another good example is while I code, sometimes I want to read the documentation and not the documentation from Xcode itself, but from maybe a tutorial or things like that. So I have my web browser open at the same time as Xcode. I agree, or I already hear the critic that says, but Luco, this is a point about the OS door that your desktop class app runs onto and not the app itself. But I think the app needs to be aware that it is not the sole proprietor of your the sole proprietor of your attention. That's the word I was looking for. It is made to be parked on the side, go do a couple of things in another software, and can easily take care of bringing data, bringing your attention back to it, and not focus on that. So it needs to be ready to live in a world where this is important. And I agree that the fact that this is important comes from a desktop class OS and not from a desktop class app. But for them to both work together, great, they need to work hand in hand. And I think that's why it is the last point I included, is because this integration or this assumption is quite important.
Or like a similar thing I can think of is like, why can't I play music and watch a video at the same time on iOS? Like you can do it if you code everything exactly correctly. Like if you are writing your own app, you can coordinate the audio player and the video player so that the system doesn't shut one down as soon as you start the other
right.
one. But in 90% of the case, your default implementation is just going to be like, no, I am the focused video media player right now, and everything else just gets paused while I'm playing. And that's another like platform limitation, but there's a lot of, well, I don't know necessarily there's a lot of it, but like if you're coming from a desktop where people do this all the time, you might be disappointed with what you can't do on the iPad.
Totally true. A couple of example of apps that I feel somewhat respect or mostly are good example of desktop class application. I've mentioned a couple already. Final Cut, Xcode, the iWork and Office suites of tools, the Adobe Creative Tool, Creative Suite of tools. Of course, I do have more photo examples, so Adobe Lightroom, Capture One. Apps that take advantage of all those points I mentioned while giving you a lot of flexibility and availability of raw power for your hardware. At this point, Yannick, that's my definition of desktop class app. Is there anything you would change or argue for or against?
No, that sounds about right.
I didn't like the long pause, to be honest.
Yeah, I was trying to think because, like, I the thing I would qualify is that, like, I use a lot of apps on the iPad to do a lot of stuff. I don't know what the structure of your episode is, so I don't want to go completely out of
you.
Order.
Don't worry, I'll stop you.
The main thing is, like, I do a lot of creative work on the iPad. I do, all of my swan song videos are made entirely on the iPad. After I have gotten my footage from the emulator that I run my games on, actually, I don't even record them on the Mac anymore. I record them on Windows now because it's more accurate emulation. Once I get my video footage recorded, I just take all that to the iPad. I do all my graphics on the iPad. I do all my audio editing on the iPad. All of that has always been iPad-centric since I started the Swan Song video series. So, like, I always do that. I edit this podcast entirely on the iPad every weekend. In fact, it is significantly faster to edit the podcast on the iPad than it ever was to do it on a desktop because of the Apple Pencil and how well integrated that is with Ferrite.
Mm-hmm.
So I think, like, I'm very much an iPad power user, but I'm also not a believer in the iPad needs to be a one-to-one analog to what we consider a desktop computer to be. I think they can have different strengths and weaknesses, and that's fine, and it differentiates the product line.
Okay, I'll stop you there.
Yeah, I thought that was a nice natural cutting point.
Okay, perfect. Because you mentioned things we'll come back to.
Yeah, I had a feeling.
But maybe if we use your, like, oh, no, I don't. Yeah. Well, all that thought about Ferrite, for example, like, because I think Ferrite is a good example of what's good and what's bad. Or, yeah, it's a good example of what's good about, I would even consider Ferrite, even if for certain points I mentioned, I think mainly the file system access, but I think it got better in the recent updates, is a good example of a great desktop class application on the iPad.
Like my main complaint about Ferrite is actually very closely related to what I said about audio streams earlier.
Right.
It's that if I'm listening to a podcast and I open the Ferrite app, by default, the Ferrite file picker has a built-in recording interface, so it just stops playing whatever I'm listening to every single time I go into the app.
Yeah, I remember on the previous product I worked on at work, we had a long-standing bug that was about, hey, I use the iPad as my point of sale system, but also as my Spotify Sonos. I forgot which tool we're using. But for historical reasons, we did support card readers that was using the audio jack.
Of course,
so it means that, of course, one way we could have fixed it, but we never, is to look at your account configuration and see if you had this one and then start a card reader. But in the end, the SDK driving this card reader was always running, and then every time you would launch the app, it would stop playing your music because the SDK was booted up. So this bug made me laugh so much. And again, we considered, and I guess I'm doing a bit of work stuff, but we considered the iPad that our merchant using as a like POS iPad. So why are you doing this? Then that's why there was never priority. But that's a good example of what you were discussing about the audio streams being cut off. So coming back to the question, are you okay we continue with that definition for desktop class? Or you have any objections?
No, I mostly agree with it, yeah.
Perfect. I think now it's time, though, to compare to the, I want to call it the traditional app, the mobile app model, which I nickname the app silo. Because since the introduction of the iPhone, and I would even say, like, I say the iPhone, but if you look at Palm OS and all the other devices, like, I think those devices, like even a BlackBerry, they were pretty good at calling things an app or an application, but having them siloed into, you go in an application, they take your whole attention, and you're kind of locked in into that silo. So what I consider the mobile silo or app silo is one app at a time. And the app knows that it is taking your whole attention because it is taking the whole screen, give or take. There's no concept of running two things at the same time unless they come from the same, application process. The app itself controls and hopefully for you can give you access to the data you produce, but in most cases, it controls and then have tight claws on the data you produce inside it. Or if you ingest data, if it's allowing to import data, when it's in the software, it's in the software. And you might not have access to its underlying database and things like that to get the data out in formats that you would use. Again, to go back to the whole user attention, context switch is made harder in those applications because they want you to be your whole attention. And like to go back to the example I was doing is, hey, I'm researching APIs, how they work. Switching from the browser to, let's say, even just a text editor would be kind of, okay, I have to go back to the home screen or use a multitasking gesture. But like in each moment, I cannot see quote-unquote both at the same time. We'll talk about the different multitasking solution of the iPad, but that's a different problem, I think, altogether. The app silo in the end kind of reminds me of old computers. Like, you do one thing and one thing only. You want to do something else? Okay, let me pause this software. Let's go to the other one. Let's go do that thing.
I mean, the original Mac until, like, Multifinder in, like, what, System 5? Was a single-tasking machine.
Right, exactly. So it's interesting to me that we kind of, quote-unquote, have to still deal with this, even on our modern computers, like an iPhone and an iPad. But I think, in the same time, it makes sense because the benefit of the app silo is once you're in it, you can control a lot of the user experience. You might not have as much density or as much information, but at least the information you have, the attention you have, you control it, and you can control it well.
I guess okay. We'll add some, because For context, like, I've been thinking a lot about the iPad version of Scissora, and I've been very blocked about how I want to do the iPad version of Scissora, because the more I think about it, the more I realize I have no way of doing the UI I actually want to do because of iPad multitasking. So maybe I should hold off until we talk about multitasking. But I think, like, there are a lot of things in iPadOS that seem like they enable more desktop class software and interactions, and in reality they end up being weird constraints that make it harder to do something desktop class on the iPad.
I have a Scissora question, and I will it's a segue to the next point. But when you were thinking about the iPad version, were you still keeping the feature like you have on the Mac right now, where Scissora itself doesn't import the MP3s you put in the system into its own catalog, but just kind of keep reference so you can store them whatever you want on the file system? Or you were forced to kind of make this a feature of Scissora for iPad because of limitation of iPadOS?
It's a complicated answer because of how the sandboxing works. I just want to give a brief technical explanation just because it makes sense. There is a hard limit to how many unsandboxed files, like files that are living in your iPad's regular file system, that you can have references to at a time. And I think it's something like 4,000 files. So the problem I have is if you have more than 4,000 songs, I need to have more than like 4,000 references to files on your iPad, and then the app stops working.
Huh. Okay. That's an interesting limitation. The reason I asked this dire question is one of the main points about the app silo versus the desktop class is owning your data. Where is it stored?
Mm-hmm.
And again, I think if we can describe the nearly, 40 years of desktop OSs, is that most of them are file system based. Like, you put your data somewhere and then you have to deal with it. It's not somebody that takes care of, it gets uploaded in the cloud, it gets like stored in different folders for you by type, whatever. Like, no, you have to do that, which has the benefit. But to bring it back as a more photo management discovery I did recently is, again, I'm using the world where Photos that app exists, or even Lightroom works like that, whether it's the classic or the new version, is everything needs to be in the catalog and the database. And if it's not there, sucks to be you. And I was watching a couple of Capture One tutorial, and it has a concept of what they call a session. A bit like, I think Final Cut works this way too, where you can have a Final Cut project and that reference to files from wherever you want in your file system. The gist of it is this thinking of the software to work doesn't need to own my data is, I think, really freeing. And while it can work in the app silo, I think that's why I nicknamed it the app silo, is no, it is something it needs to control. And it's really integral to this model of application is no. The data, whether it needs external data or not, it needs to have access to it in a controlled way. If you create data, it controls where it puts it. You don't need to care about it, which is, I think that's one of my controversial statements that you tend to agree, but not a lot of people. It's like, no, if the app controls the data, like, I don't need to care about it. And that's a beneficial point of the app silo.
Here's an interesting point also from Scissora that I was thinking about. As we've discussed previously, I like DJing sometimes, and
yes,
DJ software traditionally lets you load music from your music library on your iOS devices or whatever. Some of them also let you load from file providers, and I am not interested in integrating with the system music catalog, because the entire point of my app is I don't want to be involved with Apple Music. I want to write my own thing. So my idea to sort of expose the music that you have in my music library to those apps is I'm going to write a file provider that just shows you your music library in other apps. It's kind of a galaxy brain idea that not a lot of other applications would do, but it's the only real solution I have other than exporting a song one by one into a DJ app that's available to me.
Right.
Unless I rely on the 4,000 limit, like, unsandboxed files thing, then sure, I guess. But, like, that's awkward.
Yeah, and I think there's a precedent for this approach. Why am I blinking on the name of this app? But the Git tool,
Working Copy. Yeah, Working Copy. And I think some of the Readle apps also had that.
They expose their own data as a file provider, which I guess that's a cool idea for the limitation of each silo owns their data, and of a file provider, a file system, a file manager where you can augment its functionality using file providers. That's clever, but at the same time, like, I always feel that those are acts on top of, we don't want a real file system. That's it. We just want our own app silo, and that's it.
And the thing that bothers me about it is, like, previously you used to have, like, file provider extensions where you could write your own custom UI. Like, if you still have a copy of Transmit on your iPad, which I do because it's still the best FTP app.
Yes.
You just open it and it's like a modal window version of Transmit and you can do your whole thing. So I could theoretically have an actual music browsing UI in one of those extensions that looked like the music browsing interface in Cesura, but like Apple is backing away from that extension approach and is doing something more where it's using a prescribed UI provided by the OS that needs to look like a file system, and then browsing your music becomes a lot more awkward because then I have to choose, well, are you going to start browsing your music in folders that are named by artist, like iTunes does it on the file system? Am I going to do it by album? What if you have multiple albums I did for an artist? Like, it becomes very complicated quickly if you're locked into this one size fits all model that does not let you address the limitations of the approach that's being forced on you.
Yeah, and that's exactly where I'm going about, quote-unquote, what's missing on the iPad. Is, I don't think it's anything specific missing, but I think it's, in general, the forced approach of, we allow you to do certain things, or you should do certain things like file management the way we want you to do it, is what I think it's blocking a lot of things to grow. Because throughout the years, Apple has tried to fix multitasking, file management, and even in the more recent year, they're starting to tackle information and especially functionality UX density by bringing you denser toolbars, bringing you toolbar customization like on macOS. Like something, like, you remember when you can customize and change your things? Like, that's now in iPadOS 16 for developers to use. And it's pretty cool. It's a pretty buried to the UX.
I've never seen it once.
If you use Pages, you'll see at the end of the toolbar, they call it the toolbar, but at the top in the navigation bar, there's a new navigation bar style. And then at the end of it, there's a ... button. Which I think they call the overflowing menu. And inside of it is a customized toolbar. And it's like, oh, that's where they put it. Because you don't have a right click. Or you do when you're using a trackpad. But I digress.
I use numbers every single day. And I've never seen that thing.
Really? Okay. I also use number a lot. And I did not customize it. Because guess what? It's not something I'm used to on the iPad yet. But on the Mac... And I know that's the nerd in me doing that. Every time I install a new software and I see a Mac-looking navigation bar with a tools
always
in the bar.
Always the first thing you do.
You right-click, customize the bar, and see all the available function in there. So I'm quite happy to see that for a functionality like this, like Apple is realizing, you know what? The UI components we expose on iPadOS might not provide you the functionality density that desktop class apps can do on our desktop OSs. So let's bring that. Like, they've modified the menus to be a bit more dense and have like a hierarchical information in it so that you can say, okay, I want to not only do there's no the file bar, I'm not asking for the menu system, but at least when you do the new right click menu or long press menu, you can have a hierarchy of levels in it and AI functionality inside those menus, way better than you could use. But I think what's missing on the iPad, and we can, I will open the multitasking tangent in 3 seconds, but I think what's missing on the iPad is not technology, it's a cohesive direction. And that's what I realized in preparation for this episode. And when I go back to when I was thinking about what's missing on the iPad, is it's not the raw power. The raw power is there. Maybe certain API about the UX, yes. Like we discussed, file management, you can make it work. Yes, it's not the freeform file management system like the Finder or whatever it's called in Windows. File Explorer.
Windows Explorer.
Yeah. Windows Explorer, thank you. But at least it's more flexible than it used to be. You can have app silos-ish that are open to the world and things like that. But I think what the iPad is lacking is cohesive direction that will, by having this cohesive direction, end up with, I think, proper developers' API to support that vision. I think right now, in semi-ignoring the recent advancement, I think iPadOS and the iPad apps are stuck between iPad 3.2, if we remember the first OS of iPad, and trying to fudge in all of what power users want from macOS. And that's what we end up with multitasking on the iPad, as one example, where there was a shit ton of spaghetti thrown at the wall. And we'll see what sticks and what makes sense for the iPad after we shipped it to customer and customers start complaining, like, I guess, all the Apple podcasts, including ourselves right now. And that's kind of why I mentioned this, is because I think this cohesive direction also means Apple will have to lead by example. Yes, if we take back the example of the iWork suite, they've more or less are at feature parity with the desktop version because they dumped down the desktop version from a few years ago, or from at this point maybe 10 years ago. But
yeah,
pages, numbers, and I guess the only example not to include in this one is maybe Keynotes, because Keynotes is pretty fully fledged on both the both systems, and I don't feel I've lost functionality for the stuff I used to do on Keynote like 10 years ago than right now. But for sure, pages and numbers, I feel that they're not as crazy as, let's say, Microsoft Word or Microsoft Excel. But for sure, Microsoft Excel is pretty crazy. But the idea is the way they led by example is more or less to say, oh, for that to work on all your platforms or on the iPad as a quote-unquote desktop class app, you have to dumb it down. You have to remove functionality that doesn't make sense so that it still makes sense on your desktop OSs, but it is to make sure that you're kind of the minimal common denominator. And that, I think, is why nowadays it's hard to see good example of desktop class application, because I don't think nowadays Apple believes that you should that on the iPad. And that
they're giving mixed messages.
Yeah, that's, they say for one thing,
because like if you look at like Catalyst, yes, seems to be an implication that like you start with an iPad app and then you potentially add functionality or have parity with what's on the iPad, right? So there's that. There's all of the cursor bullshit which exists basically as half like a way to support Catalyst, like to make Catalyst stuff not a complete waste because it also works on the iPad, but
right,
also really muddies it, like the iPad doesn't know if it wants to be a desktop simulation or if it wants to be a tablet anymore, because there's so much weird mixed usage stuff going on. It's really confusing. And I think like the thing for me that really pisses me off is people don't realize the limitations that are imposed by the multitasking model. And what I mean by this is, if you want to support multitasking, you have to support the stupid iPhone with all the time, mm-hmm. which limits your decisions you can make about your UI, because you can't realistically have two completely different UIs for when you have a slim application and when you have the full screen. You can add components around the thing you present, but you can't have two completely different things. So if you're thinking about like an application that looks like iTunes, where you have the sidebar on the left and you have a multi-column table on the right with music, that makes sense when you're looking at like a full screen iPad UI, right? But then what happens if I use the multitasking view and I decide, oh, I'm going to look at it in a slim iPhone view? I essentially have to make a completely different UI, and the tools are not very good to adapt between these two things while preserving state. And it's a logistical nightmare to do that. And I think it sort of pushes people to make big phone apps, because the big phone app is going to work in all the UIs. It's going to be shitty when you use it in full screen, but it's going to work. Whereas you have to do so much more work to actually adapt, like to make something that feels desktop class when you're using it full screen and then scales gracefully to smaller multitasking views, because you don't really want to lose functionality when you slim down the thing, but you kind of don't have a choice because you don't have any right. place to put those things. And I think the tiling approach, like I'm a big believer of the tiling approach when you use like Linux window managers and all of that stuff that do all of that for you. Like, it's great, but it's a much higher density platform with much more fine-grained control over, like, your click targets don't need to be as big as your touch targets need to be and all that stuff, that you can just cram a lot more stuff onto the screen, and it's just much more immediately useful. As someone who has, like, a, quote, desktop application, and I'm thinking about, like, how do I bring this to the iPad and make it a good citizen with another thing? Like, I've been thinking for a year about how I'm going to be doing my UI. My UI only implements the feature set of iTunes 1.
No, and that's true. In the past four or five years, I had to write an app where we were a full screen app. And we were not ready to support multitasking, but the goal was to say all new UIs should support multitasking. And I remember when we had to change the big parts of our application to possibly allow us to build a mobile version of it. And it was our decisions, like how you change your navigation. And those things are core to an application. So having this more or less mix of mediums is, I think, what ends up rubbing me the wrong way. Because if I go back to throwing spaghetti at the wall, it's like, if we just end up with a mix of mediums, what is the message it sends to developer? Just do a mix of mediums. Make sure that certain functionality, like or the core functionality of a product, works on all platform. And once you have more space, or when the device is in a more dense platform, like a desktop OS, just keep the functionality for those. And I think that mentality goes against the iPad can be for, well, can be your computer. I think it goes against that for a lot of people. And on the inverse too, if that's one way to fix this mediumness that I feel that is the iPad and iPadOS is for apps is right now. But if you don't want to make the real concrete changes to make the iPad a platform dense in functionality OS, then stop trying to make it the fucking desktop computer. Like, deal with it that is just a big iPhone and that you have more space, but this bigger space is put a little bit more information at your fingertip, and that's it. It's where I feel lost a lot. And even as a user and on the other side, when I think about how developing apps, even how I think developers should build apps, is this mix of things makes it hard to build complex application. And then going back to my point about Apple leading by example, like to go back to what you were saying about the multitasking, like how can you imagine multitasking to work with Final Cut on iPad?
Exactly.
I know Final Cut on iPad doesn't exist, but
it should.
Yes, it should.
It should have existed 10 years ago.
And that's the weird message I end up with, is kind of say like, I know API wise, Apple wants you to support multitasking. As most of the app I worked on still set their flag to full screen only mode. And we haven't done feel any pressure from Apple to do that, and it still just works. But even that, I feel, is still not the best.
It's like Google Chat should definitely support split-screen multitasking, because they still don't, and it's just a giant phone app, and there's no excuse that it shouldn't support it. But at the same time, like, I understand that there are lots of constraints. Like, games, obviously, like, it's very awkward if you want to support multitasking and resize the window. Like, that's not ideal. Things that have, like a prescribed full-screen experience like that makes a lot of sense. But...
And on top of that, we come to the three different versions in the last 10 years of five different versions of multitasking. I don't want to enumerate them some, but let's do that just for the fun of conversation. There was the one that was just the side app that should show up. And there was, I think, two or three versions of what is an app that comes on top of your screen that has a kind of a phone app layout. Then you could split your screen into two.
Yeah.
In different versions. And now we have still that, plus having slide over, plus having state manager, which, before you ask, I don't have opinions, because A, I don't use it on Mac OS. Didn't feel like I need it, because I am a spaces person. And B, I don't have an iPad that, quote unquote, is able to run it, even if I have a 2020 iPad.
I do have an iPad that runs it, and I've never used it.
Right.
Because it doesn't work with how I think about using the iPad.
Fair. And it's funny, because I feel that Stage Manager would have made sense like 5 years ago on the Mac, or even 7 years ago on the Mac. Or I don't even remember when Spaces were created. I think it's more than that.
Oh, like Spaces 10, has been 15? Around since 10.5.
Right. So 10, 15 years ago for sure. But like, all of this is to say is a lot of those functionality feels to me that they should either have been created years ago or just not do them, because we're in the sea of mediums, of mediumness, I could even say. And I think the best way to fix this is more cohesion. Really step back and think what needs to happen on the iPad, because then you also end up with a lot of the people complain that, oh yeah, now we have an iPad that tries to act like a laptop, but why don't Apple ship laptops that have touchscreens? Because they can act like iPads when it makes sense for them to act like iPads. And again, you go back to this sea of mediumness.
It's really interesting that, like, in the last year and a half, I would say, a lot of the people who were hardcore into actually... using the iPad for everything, and they would come up with ridiculous hacks to actually like enable themselves to work 100% of the time on the iPad, have given up on the iPad as a platform, because there were too many mixed messages, there were too many half-assed things. And it's interesting, because I think we want very different things for the iPad. Like, what they wanted is essentially a laptop with a touchscreen, which is not at all what I want. What I want is a device that completely embraces the touchscreen and does not try to emulate the desktop in any way. And we are on complete polar opposites. And we are both frustrated with the iPad, because I think they overinvested in the desktop shit that I don't care about. And they think they haven't invested enough in the desktop shit, and they jumped ship and they went to ARM Max.
Right.
And in reality, like I've been saying all along, like if you're not happy with the iPad and its limitations, there is a platform that exists that is exactly catered to what you are looking for. It is called the Macintosh. And as long as both product lines exist, they need to find a reason to differentiate them, and they can be good at different things, and that's perfectly fine. There is a lot of shit on my iPad. Like, the obvious one is always content consumption. Like, yeah, obviously those things are going to be better on the iPad, because you don't have a giant keyboard jamming you in the ribs all day. But there are a lot of really good creative applications on the iPad that I think are better on the iPad than what you can do on the Mac. Like, I use, I know you don't necessarily like it as part of your workflow, but I love Photomator, which is the new name of Pixelmator Photo.
Oh, yeah, that's true. I forgot to change name.
I do all my graphics for YouTube in Pixelmator, which I love using for designing graphics and all that stuff. So that is perfectly great. Ferrite is transformative. Like, I have never been more efficient in editing stuff. I just wish that it had good noise cancellation. That's the one thing I needed to have. What's it called? My video editor. Fuck, I can't remember. LumaFusion.
I forgot you used LumaFusion.
Yeah, I've been using like 3 or 4 different video editing tools over the year, but right now I'm on LumaFusion. I absolutely love it. It definitely has weird file system limitations because it's an iPad app, but other than that, it works really well, and I'm very efficient at working along with it. So, like, all of this stuff, like, I don't feel like I'm compromising my experience, or not to a significant degree, to do it on an iPad. I don't feel like I'm doing insane hacks to get my work done on the iPad. I just get to work on the iPad, and it's great and enjoyable, and it's great. But I think those classes of applications are really, really well suited to a touchscreen on a tablet, and not all jobs are going to be good for that. And that's fine. Like, I think if you're going to be a programmer, yeah, the Mac is probably going to be good because it's kind of designed around mouse and keyboard, and you use mouse and keyboard a lot more for programming than you do for the stuff that I do creatively. I think as soon as the keyboard comes into the equation and it represents a large part of what you're doing, I think you should just gravitate to the Mac instead of trying to figure it out on the iPad. It's not worth it.
Yeah, no, that's totally true. And it kind of crazy because it makes me reflect on the fact that the last 5 years at least, since I have a work provided, it's an iPad Pro, the 10.5, which I got when it was released. So I think at this point it's more than 5 years. I forgot the date exactly, but
I have since no sense of time.
Yeah, me neither, that's why. And I forgot to take note of that. But what I was trying to say is, since I got this iPad has always been in some form of case, keyboard, stand-ish. Mm. And I kind of agree with you on this. And to go back to what you said about a lot of the application, is one thing I liked a lot about the iPad as a personal device is that it is different enough from my computer. And even if I know it's not work, even sometimes when I'm sitting in front of the M1 iMac that we have here at home and I need to do photo management, I kind of feel I'm doing work.
Yeah.
Because guess what? As a developer, I need to spend at least 8 hours per day in front of my computer to make my living. So I want a device that does similar things, but hopefully does it in its own way. But that is giving me this flexibility to do it in my doing Steve Jobs style, like in a couch and just chilling, or when I go see my family, when I travel and things like that. And that flexibility of this device is still what makes me fall in love with it. And that's why I'm still hopeful that we'll have a cohesive direction. If we have a cohesive direction, that is, it's just a fucking bigger phone, then I'll deal with the limit of the app silos. We've discussed multiple ways of dealing with those limits, but at least I know what I live with. If in the end it is becoming the new desktop operating system, then make it so. So bring the functionality that we need, do the commitment, bring a cohesive direction so that also third-party developers follow you. A good example and a dumb example. Yet again, photo management. I'm using Adobe Lightroom. I cannot select 3 photos, chain, add tags to them on the iPad. It's the same Lightroom. I'm not thinking about like Lightroom Classic versus Lightroom CC. Like the same Lightroom version, because the one on the iPad comes from the phone and the phone is really dumbed down. But the one on the Mac is kind of the most fully fledged Lightroom CC that exists, and the iPad is in this weird in-between. It has most of the feature of the phone, certain new feature that are available from the desktop, but not all of the desktop functionality. So to just put tags on photos, if I don't want to just do it one by one, which will be way tedious, I have to use the desktop for that. And that is one good example, not only from Apple, of just not doing the work to make the iPad more powerful. And just by And that is a good example for what I meant by functionality dense UIs. It's like, this functionality exists in your Mac code base. Like, it made sense in your less professional tool to exist on the Mac. Why doesn't it make sense to exist on the iPad if the goal is the same, to have this software do a certain number of functionality? And that, I think, comes down to nobody really knows what. We've mentioned a lot of good examples. I think Pixelmator Photo, I'll still call it this way because I forgot the new name already. So it's a Photomator. Yes, Photomator, that's good. I think it's a good example of a powerful tool that shines through the confines of the iPad and iPadOS. Ferrite is another good one, but it, at this point, 13 years in the life of the iPad, with all the changes that happened, especially in the last five to seven, let's put it this way, I should have like five apps that I can name as example of great, as great examples. Like, we should go on and on and on of application that do that. And that's, in the end, what saddens me is. And that's why I made this episode, is to kind of like reflect on what I want and especially what I think will fix the issue.
I mean, I'm also going to drop in a sly mention to App Store economics as another potential issue with that.
Who knows? Maybe this one will get fixed in the months to come. But yeah,
I think that's a social issue. I don't think that's something Apple can necessarily fix.
Yeah, that's a topic for a different episode too. I think we need to come back to, depending what happens later this year, I think we'll, spoiler alert, we'll be talking about side loading sooner rather than later.
True. Is that it?
Quick note, yes. So in the end, I think cohesive direction for the iPad is what is literally missing. And I think it shows both in hardware and software, mainly in software. And last but not least, like, the iPad for years was my primary personal computer. There was still a couple of things, like recording this podcast, I still use it. But since, I think a year ago, I forgot. No, that will be more 18 months at this point. Since I bought the M1 iMac, kind of realized that I was using it more for more quote-unquote content creation. So the things I would do in my personal life, that is to deal with data. And that's kind of why I realized, oh yeah, there are things that that I wish I could do on the Mac. And that quite saddens me, because every time I think that, I'm kind of like, oh yeah, then I'm losing the flexibility of the iPad, that it can be with me all the time. And that is something that I loved a lot. So I hope that by improving the quality of desktop class application and leading by example, that it will allow other developers to commit to those. And last but not least, allow me to use my iPad even more frequently and enjoy its flexibility as a device. And now that's it for today.
Alrighty. So you can find the show notes for this episode at limitlesspossibility.net/205, or you can find our full back catalog at limitlesspossibility.net. We are on the Fediverse at limipo_podcast at mastodon.social. We are also individually on the Fediverse. I am at Socarina at icosahedron.website, and you can find Ducadivier at
Luco, that's LUCCO, at mastodon.social.
And we'll see you in 2 weeks.
See you in 2 weeks.